This is John Udell. My guest for today's episode of Perspectives is George Ripsack. He's a professor of biomedical informatics at Columbia, and he's one of a group of researchers who are being funded by a Microsoft research program to tackle computational challenges in genetics. You are one of six recipients of funding from Microsoft Research in a program called Computational Challenges of Genome-Wide Association Studies. We should probably say at least briefly what is a genome-wide association study and what you intend to do, and then we can branch out from there.
So the genome-wide association study involves scanning markers across a complete set of DNA, or, you know, the human genome, in order to find genetic variations associated with some disease.
Specifically, what's being looked for are single nucleotide markers.
Our role in this project is the phenotype. What we're trying to address is the phenotypic computational challenge. When you do a genome-wide association study, you're associating the genotype to the phenotype. Okay, so that's the association going. And often the phenotype is simple in what you might now call traditional genome-wide association studies, where you have a disease, someone has diabetes or doesn't have diabetes, or two people have diabetes, but one gets complications and the other one doesn't.
By phenotype, you mean the expression of diabetes in this case?
Yeah. Okay. So what I mean by phenotype is the, you know, physical observable expression observable properties of the patient that we're then going to correlate. And usually, so you're starting off, often you're starting off with a disease. You have some number of patients, relatively small, sometimes a tiny number of patients, or up to several thousand patients is what I've seen mainly. And then the two groups, say a case control study where you have, again, patients with disease, patients without disease, and you then study the entire genotype and see which sites on the genome are associated with that disease. Then you look into that site. Now, the fact that you found a genetic, say, a mutation at a certain site, that's not necessarily, of course, the cause of the difference between the two sets of patients. The cause may be something near that marker on the genome, and then you might sequence the area, you might look for other information about what genes are in that area, and so on.
So the computational challenge is one of correlation.
The first step is correlation, and then the next step for other people, but I'm at the zeroth step.
Okay.
So that's what I'm getting. So there are other people who are working on this part that I'm describing now.
Okay.
Let's put it that way.
Okay.
From the genome-wide association, and then they will then take those associations. So they're going to first come up with associations, and that's a challenge in its own way, a computational challenge, because there's a vast array, say 100,000, someday a million markers that you're looking at on the genome, and you're finding which ones are associated with this trait, say diabetes or not diabetes,
okay,
or a certain subtype of diabetes, say. And then they need to take those and figure out what they mean. Like, what proteins are coded either at the marker or near the marker to figure out what this means.
Okay.
Okay. In order to get to that point, you need the phenotype also. As long as the phenotype is something simple, like patients with or without diabetes, it may seem like that's the easy part of the experiment. As time goes on, as genotyping gets cheaper, that's going to be the easy part of the experiment, and the hard part is going to be collecting the phenotype. What will happen is we'll be able to handle more and more patients as the cost goes down and as we learn to handle patient privacy. So that's the other thing that limits the study, is that we have to be careful how we collect and store these data.
So when you say collecting the phenotype, you mean basically this is clinical observation and description?
Exactly.
Okay.
So imagine, for example, that you could, let's say, as every patient who comes into the hospital, could, given the option of participating in a trial where in a secure fashion their genotype was done, and then their information could be used to discover new things about disease. Some number of patients would agree to that, and if we could be sure that we were protecting their information adequately, then what you might have is a great number of patients, and the genotype, all you have to do is take whatever blood sample you have, check the DNA, genotype it.
Yeah.
Relatively straightforward if you have the money to do it.
Yeah.
Then you have to find out, well, what is the phenotype of this patient?
Okay, I see what this is about now. Okay.
You could what questions should you ask them? Well, we don't even know what diseases we might be studying or what we might discover.
Right.
What we want to know is the whole medical course of this patient, when they've been well and when they've been sick.
Okay, okay.
And what we have for these patients are the electronic health records. And in the future, with Microsoft Health Vault, for example, we have the personal health records.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, can, with the patient's permission, can we use those data to come up with a reliable phenotype?
Okay. And this is actually, so I've looked into the publications that you've done, and so I see now how this ties into your sort of career history, which seems to be a lot about the mining of things like clinical records and health records.
Exactly.
You know, using a variety of techniques. And so, okay, I see the connection now.
So that's what we said. It might be worth Microsoft, in one of the projects, investing in the phenotype part rather than finding ourselves working hard just on the statistical models through the association.
Okay.
and the genotype part of it, and then finding ourselves way behind on the phenotype half.
Okay.
Because we've been working on the phenotype for 20 years, and it's actually a lot harder than most people think.
Well, I wouldn't think it would be easy. but you know, this is exactly what I really wanted to invite you to discuss, is what are the, you know, what is the sort of the nature of health records and clinical data, and, you know, what are the challenges unique to that kind of information in terms of making sense out of it?
So two of our collaborators are Rich Smiley and Pamela Flood, both faculty members at Columbia in the anesthesiology department, and they're studying a specific specific protein, the beta-2 adrenergic receptor, which is mentioned in the grant application. And they're sampling, say, about on the order of 2,000 patients. They're just studying two SNPs. So as I admit in the grant application, it's not a genome-wide association study. It's just a simple two SNP study.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same. They need to collect the phenotype on those 2,000 patients. And this is why this was a good test case.
Mm-hmm.
Having just for 2,000 cases, which is not a huge number, having a research nurse accurately gather all the information they need to do their study, and what they're studying is labor, preterm labor, the length of time you spend in labor, and how much pain you have during labor,
okay,
and how that's associated with this, with mutations or variations, I should say, not mutations, variations on these two sites on this protein. It's an enormous amount of work, and it may not be that reliable. Now, we have an electronic health record where for each of these patients, the nurse has sat there painstakingly documenting what he or she recorded on the patient. Plus, you know, in some cases we have monitors, we have lab tests, all fed into the electronic health record.
Mm-hmm. But much of what's there is anecdotal and textual and narrative in nature, right?
That's right. Well, actually, some of this stuff for their study, it's a mixture.
Okay.
Of structured and narrative.
Okay.
And so, ideally, we should be able to generate the phenotype for them rather than having a specific person, this research nurse, sit down with these endless charts, and 2,000 is a pretty large number to have to go through. And you might do a good job on the first one and the second one, but by the thousandth one, you may not be. It's a tedious task, and it takes a lot of work to get a high reliability result. So we're trying to do that through computation on the electronic health record. Now, the challenges on the record, you have to account for that. So that would be, there's all kinds of things that go on with the health record. Its intention is for patient care, not for research.
Mm-hmm.
And so anytime you're taking an information source and using it for a different purpose than it was intended, you have to be careful, and it often takes a lot of processing and interpretation. People use different, whether it's structured data or narrative data, like narrative text, people use different words to encode things.
Mm-hmm.
So one might be saying chest pain, another, this is not in that study, not in the labor and delivery study, but say in a cardiovascular study. Is it chest pain? Is it angina? Is it coronary artery disease or history of myocardial infarction or heart attack? All different things that are indicating the same kind of heart disease.
Right.
And so you need to roll up, so the terminology varies, and you need to come up. Often the terms are ambiguous. Someone says a person has a disease. In fact, if someone says you have diabetes, they probably mean diabetes mellitus, a problem with glucose. But there's a diabetes insipidus, which is a completely different disease.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, what's all it has in common is that you urinate a lot.
So I guess there's kind of two ways you can attack this, and probably it works both ends toward the middle. But on the one hand, you can try to provide a more structured data collection environment that is aware of these terminologies in a more precise way. And on the other hand, I guess you can do a lot of, text mining and correlation. And is that kind of how it works both ways in?
That is true, but the people who are collecting the data are not interested in your research study.
Okay.
So they're doing exactly what you said. We are working, as a nation, we're working on improving our terminology, ending up with structured data, whether you get there through natural language processing or by having the doctor fill out a template. Either way, we want to end up with computable knowledge.
Yeah.
But the purpose of that is for clinical care anyway, and so it won't exactly match what you're looking for in your research trial. So you're always going to have these kinds of problems. Furthermore, I think there's a reason why we've ended up with, just to take narrative data as an example, there's a reason why we speak in narrative data and why we don't speak in templates over the last, million years that we've been evolving. It's an efficient means of communication, and it may be true that it is best for healthcare providers and all other human beings to speak in narrative language and to have something else, as long as our systems get better, turn it into something structured. That may be the most efficient way to gather information from physicians, for example.
So I have a long-term personal interest in this question of to what extent it's possible to mine unstructured information and turn it into structure. But this is something you've done professionally for a long time. What can you say about the progress of the state of that art?
Well, we did a study in 1995 where we had 200 chest radiograph reports, so 200 chest X-ray reports, and we had 12 physicians read them. Six of them were internists and six of them were radiologists. So the radiologists are the ones who generate the reports, and the internists are the ones who generally use the reports. So we thought that was a good sample of doctors who knew a lot about reading chest X-ray reports. Remember, they weren't looking at the images, they were just looking at the reports that were dictated by the radiologist who did the initial reading. And what we wanted to see is, could we use natural language processing to process these narrative reports and say yes or no to a set of clinical conditions, like is this a report indicative of bacterial pneumonia? Is this a report indicative of cancer or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and so forth? So we had six conditions that we were looking for. And we did a study, and we actually had those doctors create a gold standard, and we measured the accuracy or the precision or, say, reliability of doctors in answering these questions. So for each doctor, we compared them to the other 11.
Okay.
And to the computer system, we compared them to the 12 experts. And what we found was that the computer system interpreting these reports and coming up with an answer to those six yes/no questions was approximately equal accuracy. So, in other words, instead of paying a physician to sit there and read 200 chest X-rays, you could have our system read it to answer those six questions and get just as accurate an answer.
And what is that system? I mean, there are a variety of general purpose NLP frameworks, and then there are all kinds of domain specific efforts. How would you characterize yours?
This one is a medical, a medicine specific system called Medley.
Okay.
M E D L E E.
Okay.
And so Medley is the product of a person named Carol Friedman, and she started building it, I think, 91 or something, 1991. Went into production use at our hospital in 1995, and that was that publication. And we've been using it ever since.
And training it as you use it?
Yes. I mean, modify. I don't know if I would call it training it. I mean, improving it as we use it. It's not a data-driven system. So as it makes mistakes, we fix it, but it's not a machine learning system.
Okay.
So
It
that's
really is a, it really is a language understanding system.
Yeah, it uses a semantic grammar, so it divides all words into semantic classes. So rather than getting into the details of syntax, like noun, phrase, and verb, what it does is, this thing is a body part, this thing is a disease, this is a procedure, this is a medication. And then it has a grammar using, instead of noun, verb, noun, phrase, the grammar has sequences of semantic types, of
Okay.
these semantic classes.
Okay.
And then it also has some syntactic parsing, like to figure out negation and like that. So it's really a blend of those two.
Okay.
And it was used initially on radiology reports, but now it's used for all of medicine. Now, it was as accurate as human beings in answering simple questions. When you get to complex interpretation, it doesn't do as well as human beings. But you're still at the point where a human being can't be expected to read a million chest x-ray reports, say, or a million discharge summaries, or a million doctor's notes.
Mm-hmm.
So we can do things that we just don't have the money for people to do. So even if the accuracy is a little bit lower than a person, it's still a useful system.
Given that context, then how, you know, is this going to be applying to the funded project?
So then those are the challenges. One is that things are narrative. Another is the terminology. Another is that the data are sometimes inaccurate, like mistakes are made in recording information in the chart. Often they're mistakes that a doctor on reading the chart would just notice it right away and skip right past it.
Mm.
It may be a subtle mistake, which is not that important in interpreting the case by in a human being interpreting the case, but might be important when you're doing a research trial and trying to automatically understand what's in the chart. There's also often missing data. The patient may go for care elsewhere. The data value may not be recorded, or the thing may not even have been tested. So you don't really have a complete record. If you're doing a clinical trial, say a randomized clinical trial, you have a lot of money to have people spend a lot of time tracking patients, following up with them, and measuring everything that needs to be measured. Whereas if you're just using an electronic health record and a personal health record, then you have to rely on whatever was collected for that purpose.
Yeah, it's going to be sparse data by definition. Exactly. For pretty much the indefinite future.
Our role is to generate a reliable phenotype from that electronic health record and personal health record. Or if it's not reliable, be able to tell that this is a case where we don't have enough information, that there's not enough data in the electronic health record for us to make a determination on the phenotype, say.
Mm-hmm. But so part of it will be about inferring what's missing to the extent that it's possible to do that? And if so, like how would you do that?
We can infer that something's missing. Now, whether we tell them to go collect it or we just say this is a case that we can't use in the study is a different question.
Okay.
What we hope to do is just to say when we give an answer, what we want to do is when we say the patient has this disease, so let me give you a concrete example. Let's say you're trying to study complications of diabetes, and you want to do a genome-wide association study on people who have had severe diabetes from the point of view of treating it with insulin, but who have had no complications versus people who have had complications, and see if there's a genetic difference, and is there something there that would, you know, point to something that would reduce complications? Could you invent a drug? If you can discover why some people don't have complications, can you mimic that in the other people?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that means I want to come up with a phenotype of people who have diabetes severe enough to be treated with insulin but who don't have complications. So let me use I want to use my electronic health record to identify those people. What will be the challenges there? Well, one challenge is, what if I have someone who comes here for their diabetes care because there's an expert at my medical center here, but when they have complications, they go to the nearest hospital. And so my electronic health record doesn't have the data about their complications.
Yeah. Well, of course, this is the whole promise and holy grail of federated health records, right?
Right, and RIOs and Health Information Exchange.
Yeah.
But this is just one example of many problems that can come up. So when you're trying to identify someone who hasn't had complications, you don't know if you're missing the data or if they truly are without complications. So it would seem almost insuperable, but in fact, it's not that hard. You can use information theoretic methods to figure out, look, I have enough information that if this person had complications, I would know it. If this person has a history and physical by an internist or three different internists over the course of 10 years and none of them have ever mentioned a complication of diabetes, then odds are this patient doesn't have complications of diabetes because one of those three internists would have noticed it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's information in the record that would tell me that this is actually a person who's been at least maybe hasn't had no complications, but at least has a few complications.
So you're sort of interpreting the negative space.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And whereas another patient where they came in for, something early on, they have diabetes, we know they're on insulin, then they disappear for 5 years, and they come in and they have a complete blood count but not a glucose, and they have some minor, ambulatory surgery, say a dermatologic procedure, and they disappear for 5 years, and they're here now. I don't know at all that person doesn't have any diabetes complications. All I know is they came in for a minor dermat, like have a mole removed.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives me no real information about whether they have diabetic complications like, say, ophthalmologic complications and so forth.
Yeah, I see what you mean. It's, that's really interesting. Let me ask you this then, since we've been talking about electronic health records and it's a subject that's just kind of moving into the mainstream. Google Health was just announced, you mentioned,
right,
Microsoft Health Vault. Most people yet have not really encountered this in their kind of daily interaction with the healthcare system, and I assume that 5 years from now a lot of people will have. But you mentioned something I think pretty interesting, which is that I think a lot of people have the notion that that this information that is being collected in these health records will be of value, not only clinically, but also to research. And your point is, no, not necessarily. And the question would be, if you were the czar of all of this, what would you like to see done to kind of merge those two goals and make it be so that the routine collection of clinical data is also done in a way that is, most likely to be helpful for research?
Well, I would first start off with a caution. There's a knee-jerk reaction to say that what we need to do is have doctors document more accurately and more completely.
Yeah, that would be the obvious
thing.
And that
would solve all our problems, that we would have better billing compliance.
Uh-huh.
Because the people who pay for health care want to see that certain things are done. They want the doctors to document accurately.
Yeah.
JCHO, the regulators, want to see certain things. The problem is that you end up with a very long structured template of stuff. What I envision is an intelligent record that produces a summary for a clinician that they can read, perhaps get rid of things that are wrong, and then write their note, which is a succinct summary of their thinking.
Uh-huh.
That's what I would like to see for the optimal quality and efficiency of healthcare. That doesn't answer your question, which was, how does that then get used for research?
Yeah.
Other than, to the degree that we make documentation efficient and serving healthcare, I think it will then be more accurate for the sake of research. I think one thing that can go wrong, just to give an example, is if you're filling out a record for the sake of billing, you will then have an incentive to use diagnosis codes that optimize billing.
Mm-hmm.
And does that then reflect clinical accuracy? And then would that be useful for research?
Right.
So I think the important thing is to be grounded in the clinical truth, that is, the putting healthcare first, and using new computational methods to extract from that accurate information. I guess that's how I'd put
okay.
it.
Okay. And
that
it
could
sounds
be natural
like
have them speak natural language processing, maybe they review it, or just maybe the methods become close enough that they can speak and use natural language process information manual review. We've done that in some cases.
Okay. So clinical truth is what the doctor said in the doctor's own preferred language. Although I think to a large extent there's also a lot of shared convention around the terminology.
They learn in medical school and through various parts of their professional lives what to document. It's not all called the same thing, and the nation is working on healthcare standards in various ways, both for transferring information between two systems and for coming up with a common vocabulary, say quality indicators.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would be an example where they're trying to get people to agree on what it is we should be looking for.
But it's really interesting to hear your perspective on this, because what it sounds like you're saying is that although a lot of people, and probably me among them, would imagine that what those kind of terminology or vocabulary standards boil down to are fields in a template, what you're saying is that that's really not necessarily the first and best strategy. You know, what you'd like to have is that terminology incorporated into the language that these people actually speak when they do these narratives, and that the, you know, and that we can then on the back end harvest out of that what we need.
Well, you know, when they speak, or that such that however they do speak, we can then interpret it into something that is standard.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like that a lot. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, it hinges on your perception of the state of natural language processing. But you have obviously got a view of that in this particular domain, and a high degree of confidence in, you know, in sort of where it is. And do you see it, you know, kind of improving and converging?
I should emphasize, it's not perfect. We achieved expert-like performance on a relatively simple task. On more complex tasks, as I said, we have less than expert performance, but not bad performance, and good enough given that you're trying to read a million reports at once.
Yeah. And how is that progressing? I mean, you said this was introduced in, I think, the early 90s, right? So how do you see it progressing and kind of converging on better accuracy and more complexity?
What we've done, I would say that what we've done is mainly expand our breadth more than improve the accuracy over the years.
Okay.
Because in other words, in 95 we were doing, or 92 to 4, we were doing mainly radiology reports, and now we cover, you know, most of medicine.
Yeah.
So our work was there. I don't know if the accuracy got better. Modern natural language processing systems are often depend on machine learning and don't have deep linguistic knowledge in them.
Well, they're both breeds. You know, kind of going down parallel tracks, it seems to me, and there, you know, there are lots of semantic systems happening too that really are like yours.
We're seeing in medicine probably more emphasis on statistics today than linguistics.
Okay.
But we believe that the right answer is a combination of the two.
Okay.
And we've tried some statistical approaches too, but our semantic system seems to outperform them, at least as a general-purpose system. So there are systems that, if you have a specific question, and that's the only question you want to answer, a statistical system is probably a more efficient way to go. What we do is we actually parse the entire report and spit out everything we can figure out from that report,
mm-hmm.
rather than just going in and saying, remember in that 1995 study, our goal was to answer 6 questions, but our system actually parsed the entire report,
mm-hmm.
said everything it knew, and then we found in those things that it said, you know, which ones indicated pneumonia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Systems that are designed to answer one question can, there are various techniques you can use that do pretty well on a single question, but don't do well if you're saying, I'm going to throw in an entire history and physical, tell me everything there is to know about the patient.
Mm-hmm.
That's what our system is good at.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what Medley's good at. Systems should make it easy for people to express what they need to express, in this case, the clinical truth.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever, if it turns out that a super efficient template model works, then that's great. I think it's basically an empirical study to see what does work best, and people will experiment over time and see what works.
Yeah, and you also mentioned the kind of compromise approach, which is to summarize and then present for approval or refinement and correction.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've been trying that too?
We've done it in prototype, but we haven't put it into production.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think clinicians really want to stop and correct. And so what we need to work on is a way of presenting the structured format that is usable and useful enough to them that it's worth that extra time to do that.
Yeah, this is really a perennial and vexing problem. And in some ways, you know, I think this is the ultimate grand computational challenge, right? It is exactly this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's exactly at that sort of interface between the, you know, the data collection and the human being who's, you know, always going to regard any sort of data collection device as an impediment, ultimately, right?
Mm-hmm.
It never seems to be your friend. It's always your enemy. When does this project start? The one that was funded.
Well, we're starting. I mean, we're actually already for that study, the preterm labor and length of labor study of Rich Smiley and Pamela Flood. We're already taking data out of the electronic health record and turning it into a phenotype for them to do their associations.
Okay.
So we're already working on that. Over the summer, we're working on, so that's, you know, it's nice to have a concrete problem to work on. Over the summer, what we're working on is a generic framework. So how does the next person and the next person do this? How do we make this in a repeatable, generic fashion, rather than just having one person go and do all the queries and all the processing that would be necessary?
Okay.
And then we'll be working on putting together a pipeline of tools to do that. You'll still need a person there to process the data, but they won't be reading every chart.
Well, this sounds hopeful. And so thank you for your time. This was enlightening, and I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, John.
Take care.